Welcome to this forum on wetbacks and dry bones in El Paso. I'd like to begin by sharing some reasons why I want to share on this topic. First of all over the United States there are congregations, and I know more the Lutheran congregations, but I'm sure this applies to others too, that are dying literally as a result of the influx of new minority groups. Not so much as a result of the influx of minority groups, but not knowing what to do with this reality and not being willing to incorporate these people into their community. I'm very concerned about this as I travel around California, Texas, and other areas where there are lots of Hispanics. I see too many cases of congregations catching on too late. You know, maybe they were 1,500 members and all of a sudden all the people see the inevitable beginning to happen, so they move to another community and more or less let their congregation be left to whatever happens. And then the few who stay on kind of struggle and become concerned about what to do with so few resources to keep up this huge building that they built years ago. It's a very typical pattern, and it's something we need to be aware of and concerned about. And so I want to share about this because it's a reality that we see. Another reason is because of the real demographic situation that we have at this time. Hispanics are fast becoming the most numerous minority group in our country. It will be only a few years now until they will be the largest group, outnumbering the blacks. We feel this way because, first of all, there's a tremendous birth rate among the Hispanics. They have a lot of children. They like kids. And also, there's a large movement of Hispanic people, especially at this time, from Mexico and Central America. If we have time, we can talk about that whole situation a little more. Then I think along with that demographic reality, though, I would like to just say that more and more Anglos in certain areas see themselves as a minority. And this creates some resentment. They say, what's happening? You know, we're being overrun, we're being taken over. And this can lead to anger and in turn finally to violence if it's left unchecked. This is the kind of thing that has occurred in other countries where you have large minority groups coming in. And we're not immune from that just because we think we're more enlightened. Another reason I want to share about this is to help others understand, because I believe understanding leads to growth, and growth leads to change. And to raise your consciousness a bit today may be helpful to you in your own setting. Perhaps you don't have a Hispanic group in your community, but it may be that you have an Indian community, or a black community, or a Hmong community, or some other Asian group. In any case, we have this phenomenon in our country more and more of minority groups within the Anglo setting. And how do these groups live and work together? I think we're finding also that more and more these groups are not integrating as quickly into the old American system. What did we used to call it? The melting pot? I'm not sure that's what we have now. I think we've got a porridge, maybe, you know, with all the different ingredients, but you can still see all the ingredients very clearly and taste the difference. So this is what we have now, rather than some kind of stew that's all mixed up so much that you can't tell what the original ingredients were. You can see those ingredients very clearly now, and this could lead to serious problems unless we are able to deal with it. Then the final reason I want to share with you on this topic is to encourage. I don't want to give the impression at any time to say, look at what we have done, but rather look at what God is doing. What God is doing in our particular parish and what he can do in other places. And maybe to put it in a good perspective, we could say, if he can do this with people like us, surely he can do something real great where you are. And we recognize that God is not through with us either. We know that we have a lot of growing to do as a parish and as people who are involved in our parish and working in our parish. by His grace, we have a small part in helping to bring about some understanding and helping to heal some of the division and misunderstanding and able to incorporate Hispanic people into God's kingdom in our particular location. So those are some of the reasons that we wanted to share with you today. Now, I think it'd be helpful before we tell you our story about our parish and what is happening there to give you a little bit of a background about the location and what we call the ambiente. That's a good Spanish word for the setting, the situation itself, and the background both of the congregation and of ourselves. First of all, our location is quite unique. We're a very isolated place. If you have ever been to El Paso, would you raise your hands, please? A few, wow. I bet you didn't go to El Paso just because you had to go to El Paso. You were on your way somewhere, right? Okay, that's what we find. Nobody comes to El Paso unless they're on their way to California or some other special place. But El Paso Juarez is becoming a very unique city. I guess we would call it a twin city. It's very much like St. Paul, Minneapolis in population. We have 1.5 million in our twin city area, 500,000 in El Paso and 1 million in Juarez. Although Juarez has less than 1/3 of the space, physical space, that El Paso has, they have twice the population. They have a way of being cozy and kind of moving in together. But you would be amazed to get into some of the new barrios and see the hundreds of people just milling around. The little children, you can't even count them. They move around so quickly. So it's a very interesting thing. And El Paso goes on forever, you know. It's just the desert's there, and you can just build new houses forever and ever until you can't see any further. So they just spread it all out, and you have to drive forever to get to visit your members. And I'll tell you about that in a minute. There's an interdependence in our cities. El Paso, Juarez depend upon one another. We share the same water supply, which in the Southwest is an important issue. There's a huge reservoir under the ground, and El Paso and Juarez have to share that. And we're about to run out of that water, so now we're having to figure out ways to get it from New Mexico that's nearby. And they're not too eager to let us have it. So we may have to join New Mexico and leave Texas to get this water. So kind of an interesting thing there. The economies are very related. We have what are called the twin plants in El Paso and Juarez. That means that there are offices on the El Paso side, administrative offices usually for a big company. These are often high-tech types of businesses. And on the Juarez side, they have the factory where many times large numbers of women especially are employed to put these little transistors together and all this. And then there are special relationships between the two countries to allow the movement of this material back and forth so that you can take advantage of the cheap labor. The idea is to give opportunity for jobs to Mexican people in their country. Hopefully the idea of the American side is to keep them over there, I guess. And on the other hand, it makes cheaper materials for us, or cheaper products for us. So it's supposed to benefit both groups, but frankly I have my doubt about that. First of all, there's some tremendous social implications. When you have all the workers being women, that means that all the men are unemployed, and so they're sitting home not knowing what to do, and you'll see them out drinking beer together with their buddies, and the poor woman goes home and has to do all the work at home too, because if you're a macho, you wouldn't do housekeeping and become a house husband, is that what they call it? So that's just a quick overview. We can't go into that because that's not our topic, but just to help you see a little bit of the confusion of our area. The cultures affect one another very much. Anglos, who are totally negative toward Mexico in their attitude, love Mexican food, you know, and they never think about the inconsistency. It's just real interesting. They make it themselves. They love it. Our potlucks are very unique, even though we have mostly Midwestern transplants. They're almost 80%, would you say, Hispanic food, and it's just real super, real good. I just wanted to make a disclaimer before I go much further, too, about the term wetbacks. Actually, that was just to get you here this morning to make you think that was, I thought wetbacks and dry bones sounded kind of neat together. But I felt a little uneasy putting down wetbacks in the first place because, first of all, to be perfectly honest, you can't get your back wet coming from Mexico to El Paso because the river is too shallow at that point. You would only get your feet wet. So that's not really a true term. In fact, the only place I can figure out you could get your back wet would be down at Brownsville, because over at Tijuana, it's certainly too, there's not a river to cross it, so you wouldn't get your back wet. You might get it scraped on the barbed wire or something, but that would be it. And I think it's a kind of a disparaging term. It's sort of like when they call us gringos. And of course, there's a way to say you're a gringo as a friend. You know, I have Mexican friends. They'll say, oh, you old gringo, you know, and they kind of mean it in a neat way. But there's a way to say it that makes you feel real hurt, too. So we don't like to use that term wetback. It's kind of disparaging, really. But at least it makes you understand what area of the country we're from. Do you have wetbacks in Canada, too, or from Canada? Hope there's no Canadian wetbacks here this morning. Okay. A little background on our congregation. I think I'll ask Grace to share about that, if you would. Could you do that?
He didn't tell me this, so I don't know what I'm supposed to say about the congregation. The congregation is...
About 90 years old.
Yeah, okay. About 90 years old, I guess. And is primarily made up of people from the Midwest. Many of the people have been there for 40 and 50 years, and they're second generation or third generation. They've stayed there. The only real new blood that we, because of being the inner city, the mother church, the only new blood that we're really getting is from the Army base, because Fort Bliss is there, and that's a very big air defense and Army base. So we get a lot of people from there. And a few others who, for one reason or another, are attracted to an inner city church because we are known as kind of the evangelistic church in town as far as the Lutherans go, and so we do get a few people. But the churches that are on the outskirts of town are growing a lot faster because they are right in the subdivisions that are growing up around them. And then we see our prime purpose as being to reach, we are completely surrounded by Hispanics for 10 blocks every direction. There's no Anglos living at all. And so we really feel that if we are to survive, because these people that have been there 50 years are certainly going to die at some point, and if we are to survive, there has to be a beginning into the community that we find ourselves in.
And I think we want to do more than just survive. We want to be in mission winning as well as we can. And if we die sometime down the road, if we've done some good things along the way, I guess the Lord can deal with that too, and we're not going to worry about that. But it doesn't look like we're ready to turn up our toes quite yet. I think some neat things are happening, and it's really surprising sometimes to us to see what is happening. A little bit more about the background of the congregation is that it's like many Missouri Synod churches in that it's a very German kind of congregation. Most of the members came there for various reasons. A lot of the older members came because of TB, believe it or not. The sanatoriums for those years before modern antibiotics were in El Paso and that area. And so we had a number of big hospitals for people with TB, and so many of our members came for the climate. It's hard for us to believe nowadays because of the pollution in El Paso, but at one time it was real clean air and dry climate, so it was supposed to be good for you. I think a story that one of the older members told me one time kind of helps you to get the feel for the roots of this parish. She mentioned that back in World War I, the pastor always spoke German and the people mostly spoke German, and the pastor always having the guys over to his house, the single German men would come over in the evening and talk in German, and they would, you know, talk about the old country. And she claims that the FBI used to sit on the roof and listen through the vent to hear what was said, because they felt that this group of people might be plotting, you know, with the Germans, some kind of plot to overthrow the government. So there was that kind of cultural beginning. It's quite interesting to think about, because now we're moving into another culture working with Spanish-speaking people, and some of the same people whose parents and grandparents spoke German are now having to face the transition to a different language. So it's quite interesting how history repeats itself. I guess another way to describe our congregation would be to say, like the old joke, we're like the Republican Party of Prayer. And that shows kind of the attitudes of our people being very similar and very much conservative and so forth. And this was a setting we found. People who were very isolated from the rest of the church, even. We're a part of the Rocky Mountain District, and that goes all the way to Utah, believe it or not. So when we were driving up here last week, we could hardly believe that our district would go that far. But we're at the far end of the district. Our closest congregations in our circuit are like 200 miles away. And, you know, you just feel like you're at the end of the world. So this maybe has been a blessing, too, because we can try new things and nobody in Denver is going to know. Nobody in St. Louis certainly would know what you're up to. See? And, of course, for the people in Wadi's, that's at the end of the world for them, too. That's the last place a person would want to go. For Mexico City, you know, if you wanted to be close to good hospitals and culture and all of this, it's sort of the end of the world for the Mexican folks, too. Now, Grace, would you share a little bit on our background before we get into our ministry, just so we can see how these strange people came together with this other strange group of people at the Zion Lutheran?
Well, before going to Zion, we served 11 years as missionaries in Venezuela. And Steve was primarily responsible for evangelism program known as Cristo para Todas las Naciones, Christ for the Nations. And it was broadcast in Venezuela, Colombia, Ecuador, Peru, Argentina, and Bolivia. And so he traveled frequently to those places. There was a contact office. It was primarily evangelism using radio and the newspaper and some limited television. Because of that experience, when we had the opportunity, we felt we wanted to come back to the States because our children were all born there, and we wanted them to. We saw in children who never had the opportunity to live in the United States that they were very confused about who they were, and we wanted ours to know who they were as Americans, but we also wanted them to be proud of their heritage too. And so we felt that it was time to come back to the States. And we felt that we wanted to remain. The Lord had given us this 11 years for something, and when you learn another language and another culture, I think He would want us to be wise stewards of that and continue to use it. And I guess that's how come He directed us to El Paso. It's not exactly the place that I would choose to live. But we say we have real neat people there, and we do, thankfully, because otherwise it wouldn't be the most desirable location. And we find the ministry is very tough because of the setting, and because it's just very hard in general to work with Hispanics. They don't respond the way we respond to anything. And so it takes a lot longer than we would like to see. But that's kind of why we're there. We felt that it would be good to remain in a bicultural situation, and we certainly can do that.
In my work with the Spanish Lutheran Hour, I had a chance to work with all the different Lutheran churches, including the Germans and the Scandinavians and the LCA and the ALC people. And it was really a fantastic growing experience. We worked also with the Roman Catholics and with other church bodies too. So it was a very ecumenical kind of experience. We felt very happy to be able to relate to a fellow Christian, and we didn't worry too much about what their brand was, because we were so happy to find a fellow Christian in that setting. The real enemy was the world in a very real way in Venezuela. And so you can imagine, into this setting come these transplanted Anglos who had been, you know, kind of transformed in a certain new way into Latin American thinking people, coming back into a very conservative, isolated Missouri Synod kind of a parish. Does this help you to see that there could have been a real conflict, really? But I realized that, and I'm thankful that God gave me some wisdom at that point. I'd have to give him the credit, but I had some presuppositions, and I'd like to share some of those with you, because as I look back on my ministry now for the last 5 years, I'm really convinced that these principles and that these presuppositions help to make happen what has happened. One of the presuppositions I had was that all the baptized members are ministers, and I'm here to help them to discover, develop, and deploy their spiritual gifts. All of us should be in ministry together. That was my first presupposition. Another presupposition was that outreach in El Paso has to include Hispanics, and because 65% of the population of El Paso is Hispanic, my feeling was that we could not ignore in any way that population. And while Grace mentioned that we're in a very Hispanic neighborhood and some of our sister parishes are in more suburban areas, the fact is there are Hispanics in every community. And I constantly challenge our other pastors and congregations who tend to want to cop out on this issue to see that they too have a real challenge to reach out to their Hispanic neighbors. But one of the disturbing things, this is sort of parenthetical here, that has occurred is they keep referring to Zion now as the Hispanic parish, even though we have very large or much larger Anglo group than we do Hispanic still. But it's sort of a way of saying, and we've even had people say who've come to our church, we were told to come here because we're Hispanic, and we were told that this is where Hispanics belong. And that does kind of illustrate the attitude of many other people. I know that sounds a little critical, but that's the truth. Number three, I had a presupposition that members of Zion are unique. I didn't know how unique they were until I began to work with them a little bit. But the congregation itself is unique too, and I needed to understand this uniqueness as much as I tried to understand the uniqueness of my Venezuelan people when I worked with them. There I was very patient, and I said to myself, I need to be just as patient with these people because they have a history, they have a culture. Their culture on the border makes them even unique and different from the other people we might work with in Iowa or someplace. And that was a very important principle, and I was really thankful for that insight, and I think my mission experience helped me to see that better than maybe if I'd been right out of the seminary. I think I could have blown that place up right out of the seminary as I think back. Number four was I understood that the mission is God's mission, not mine as a pastor, and not the people's as their exclusive thing, you might say. We're all involved, but it was really God's mission, and we needed to discover that and celebrate that fact. Number five, I was committed not to preserving the status quo, but to new life, and I realized that this would have to come slowly, that this new life was the goal that we were looking for, learning to let the Spirit lead us, but going at His pace, in a sense, not changing things overnight, but trying to be consistent as a prophet to bring out what needed to be done, but pastorally caring for the people at the same time. Sort of the thing that you're working on now, I guess. That's been a struggle sometimes, but we've tried to do that. And then number six, that outreach and inreach need to be more in balance. As I saw the parish, it wasn't hard to see from day one that it was really an inreach parish. They were great about that. They had potlucks all the time. They were a family in every way. There were large numbers in our parish of people who were part of the same biological family. So you had three generations often, the grandparents and the young couple and then their kids. So it was a very unique parish in that way. We were a very friendly kind of parish. And that yet needed to be balanced with outreach. There was very little outreach going on. Number seven, I felt that if the cultures that were coming together in that place, Hispanic and Anglo particularly, couldn't come together in the church, where could they possibly come together? That was my premise. And that we should show the way through love and not through force, as has been done sometimes through government force and other agencies, like the Army has done a very good job through essentially forcing people to be together, you know, in the armed services. But I thought it needed to happen through a real concern for people and love as the motive rather than just forcing. And then finally, number 8 was the presupposition that Bible study and prayer would provide the blueprint and the motivation for our ministry and what we would do together. That would kind of give us our marching orders, that we would find our way with God's help, studying the Word together, really getting into the Word and helping all of our members come closer to the Lord and His direction through Bible study. I like to say at this point, because I don't know if it'll come out anywhere, one of the things that I'm most happy about in our parish is that this reality has come about. There's a lot of room for improvement. We want to still get even higher percentage of our people involved in Bible study, but I think considering from where we've come, we have arrived at a fairly healthy situation where we have now, in addition to Sunday morning Bible classes, at the present time, 9 neighborhood Bible classes. See, our parish is located all over the city, so we're a citywide parish, and many of our members live as far as 20 miles away. So for them to have ongoing opportunities for Bible study, we've had to come up with different ways to do this. And this has really, in my opinion, made the difference. People have learned to know each other as they pray together around the scriptures. As they have shared the word together, they've grown and dealt with a lot of their doubts and questions. And this has been a real special thing to see. Okay, well, we've done a lot of introducing here. What would you say if I told you that 30 Anglo members of our parish were studying Spanish from a Hispanic member? Fantastic. 5 years ago, I would have said that would be impossible. 2 years ago, I would have said it was highly unlikely. But I have to say, through God's grace, this is happening. And I want to say this, too. I had absolutely nothing to do with it. I really can say that in all honesty, because I didn't even know it was going to happen until it happened. Nobody asked me permission, which is fine. They didn't come to me and say, "What do you think about this idea, Pastor?" I guess they thought I would be in favor of it. But all of a sudden, a group of people decided they should learn Spanish because they were finding out that they couldn't communicate with some of the people they were having to minister to and coming in contact with, not only in ministry that we were providing, but in their own neighborhoods, next door, and so forth. Just, it seems like awareness just came together, and it sort of happened. So this is actually happening, and we're really thankful for it. I think it gives an example of some of the ministries now that we'd like to share with you. Grace is going to talk about one of our outreach ministries with Hispanics, and it's our San Antonio Street ministry.
Okay, we have for 4 years now been involved in a street mission on a street that's called San Antonio Street. And originally we used an empty school that is no longer used for normal education, but rather for adult education, and so it was available on weekends, and we rented a room there, and we were able to use that for several years. And now the last year we have renovated a storefront, and we're using that. And our primary emphasis there is to reach the children through what we call Christian fiestas that we have on Sunday afternoon. And we have sometimes as many as 10 or 15 people involved from our congregation who will help in any way to bring off these fiestas, and sometimes we've only got 5 or 6. There's a basic core of 4 of us that are definitely responsible for being there, and then it expands and grows and is smaller depending on people's schedules and activities. And during these fiestas we use films, we use singing, a lot of singing, And we do follow a Sunday school format, and for that we are using English materials, and they're produced by David Cook rather than one of the Lutheran publishing houses, because all of the Lutheran publishing houses have a tendency to assume that kids know a certain amount before you pick up the Sunday school booklet, and that just does not work in a situation like we find ourselves in. And we find that David Cook Publishing has material that is certainly geared for people who are not from a Christian background and certainly not from a Lutheran background, and so we use their materials and just try to in everything that we do build up in the children's minds their own worth, that they have a worth in the sight of God, and that there are some goals that they can set for themselves and not only grow as Christians, but also set some higher goals for their personal lives, because that area of El Paso has a very, very poor school district. And it's not unlikely at all to have 60 kids in a classroom. The children that I teach are fifth and sixth graders, and they are reading on a second grade level. And the girls are 13 years old, and all the time now, all they're talking about is boys, which is quite common also in an American setting. But in their setting, I know that maybe in 2 years they're going to be married and end up having children with the equivalent, you know, they may have some paper that says that they went through eight grades, but they're going to really only have like a third grade education. And that's real unfortunate, because that puts them possibly on welfare rolls down the line, because they're just not going to be able to compete in our society. So I just really always deal with these kids in a manner that I want them to try so much harder. We do things like taking them on field trips. We have two professors in our congregation from the university, and they'll take them to the university, and they'll take them to the mechanical engineering department or the computer sciences department and show them actually what's going on, not just books, because books are frightening to a lot of people, but show them something that is a hands-on type of education. And then just, you know, really try to plant the seed that, you know, maybe you could go to university someday. And it's just really to try and help them set some higher goals at the same time that we teach them about the love of Jesus.
You want to tell them what to use?
Oh, and there's also a real neat thing has happened. Last summer, the summer ministries team that was there worked more on an intensive basis with these kids. And during the vacation Bible school, for the first time, we actually had some teenage boys come. And they came because we had a young man from Minneapolis who was just a real, what's the guy that, you know, that everybody follows? Well, a charismatic type or the Pied Piper type of individual. And these teenage boys liked that, and these boys came carrying knives and chains, etc. They were a South El Paso gang. And I really think they came because they thought, you know, we're going to really pull some stuff here and kind of frighten everybody, etc. And this Ralph, who was the kid from Minneapolis, he just had a real neat way with them, till that by the time he was ready to go back for more training and leave, he just stood up in front of our congregation on the last Sunday there, and he said, I know a group of seven boys that need somebody. And he said, you know, he had tears in his eyes, and he just said, you know, somebody has to keep meeting with these kids on a regular basis, or they're going to all be in jail. He said, it's, you know, it's just that clear. And we had two young men in our congregation. One is about 40 and single. And I guess you can't call that. Yeah, it's young yet, right? Right. since I'm 40, that's young. another guy was in his early 20s, and those two made the commitment to take these boys, and they worked out a program with the Y that they can take them there every Saturday for weightlifting and swimming, and they meet for Bible study at the Y, And they'll study the Bible, and then they'll go and work out in the weight room, and then maybe they'll sit around and talk for a while, and then they'll swim for a while, and et cetera. And all of these seven boys, and it's grown to include a few more now, they've all committed their lives to Christ now. And they're not attending Lutheran services. We're not trying to make Lutherans out of them. We want them to be Christians first and to really feel a commitment to Christ. And if they decide to, you know, join a Lutheran church, that's down the road. But at this point, they are attending services with the one young man. And he is taking them to a service that is not as formal as a Lutheran service. And it's also a service where there is parts where there are they can put on headsets and hear the service being translated, because a couple of these boys are not real fluent in English. But that has just been a really neat thing to see, that these boys are not a gang anymore. They're still the same group, but they're not a gang anymore, and they've just made remarkable change in their life. But these two guys that are working with them have to be on them. Have to be with them all the time. It's not the sort of thing that you can let go and back off, because otherwise they'll fall. There's the temptations are just too great. There's just too much of the world around them.
Then another one of our members, a lady, works with the teenage girls in a separate program similar to this, and it's really going quite well too as far as the relationships are concerned. We're not getting these kids into the church yet, but they're starting to talk to each other, which is something that we've been taking for granted. They didn't know each other that well and weren't trusting each other. And now through the different experiences they've had, they've learned to trust and talk to one another. This is one step toward growth we see. I just wanted to mention one thing before we leave this particular ministry, is that the reason we chose this particular place of service is, first of all, it was the location of our original Zion Lutheran Church back in 1896. And it had been abandoned, the area, by the Lutheran Church, and we had moved over to another area, which is now not a suburb at all, but very much central city. But this was the inner city, if you will, you know, and we just saw that there was no church doing anything, so we felt that, why don't we go back to the scene of the Germans and see if we can work with the Spanish now. That was kind of the reason we went there. I'd like to share now another ministry that we've been working with, and that is are working together with fellow Lutherans in Juarez and Chihuahua City, Mexico. Juarez is across the river, as I said, and Chihuahua City is the next nearest city in Mexico. It's about 5 hours south of El Paso. Similar terrain, similar geography. We're all part of the Chihuahua Desert, which goes almost up to Albuquerque. It's a huge desert area. And we have been working together with fellow Lutherans in these two places in the following ways. When I came to El Paso, I felt a great need to be communicating in Spanish with a fellow pastor, and I found very quickly Pastor Martinez is a real brother. He was a pastor from our church working in Juarez, in a little church, struggling along with very few resources, and he was much more isolated than I was, because I had other English-speaking pastors in El Paso with whom I could talk, but he had no one, and it was just like a blessing for both of us to have this chance to continue to share and help each other. And so this is the kind of relationship we developed. And one of the things we do together is we produce a daily telephone message service. I usually write the message, and Jaime Martinez is his name, tapes it. And the people in the two cities can call on the phone and listen to this message and leave their name and address if they want literature or materials or a Bible course or counseling. And we try to visit these people if there's a serious problem. However, it's difficult to visit everyone because we just don't have the time and the resources to do that. But it's a ministry we've been doing together for about 5 years now. Another sharing that we've done with the churches in Juarez, or the congregation there, when we arrived 5 years ago, we found that that little parish was worshiping in the parsonage in the, it was only two rooms, the kitchen and a larger L-shaped room that had the pastor and his wife had their bed in that room. And so when the people would come for worship, they'd have to put the bed up against the wall. And we saw that it wasn't very satisfactory. Their church itself, which was right next door, had fallen down. It was made out of adobe and it wasn't built properly originally. And so what we were able to do here was to get some of our members who were in the construction business and others who were retired to commit to working together with their members. And essentially what happened was we helped build a new church in about a year and a half, and they have a new place of worship now, which was real neat. And it gave us a chance to work together side by side with them. And I think it gave our people a new appreciation for the struggles that these folks have and a feeling that they can work together in something. We've continued to work with this parish now and helping them grow as much as possible in evangelism too, because it isn't helpful to have a new building if you don't know how to reach out to people. So we share together, and sometimes Pastor Martinez and I, when we have time, we work on a sermon together. And it's a kind of a subtle way that I can help him grow in his theological understandings, because his background wasn't real complete or real. Sometimes they didn't teach him some of the things that he needed for ministry. But I can't just say to him, you know, Jaime, you've got a weakness here, and I think this is where you should work on. So I kind of try to say, well, why don't we work on the sermon for next week together, and we'll sit down and kind of draw out some of the points that we could bring up. And I don't think he realizes that I'm trying to share, but I learned some things from him too. It's not just a one-way thing. Then we've also been helping now in the last year and a half our sister congregation in Chihuahua City to do the same thing. They're building a new church. It's a little further away, so we've been helping mostly with helping to find someone to draw the plans for the church and help them get started with the program and find a contractor and these kinds of things. And also we've handled the financing and getting funds from various sources to get to them and help in order to pay for the various stages. They're about ready to dedicate now, so this is helpful. And we do go down occasionally to work with them in certain little projects, evangelism or painting a member's house or something like that, just to keep a contact. Another ministry that Grace is going to share now is about the Isleta Mission in El Paso that we've had some contacts with and involvement with.
I think we have to move on a little quicker, so I'm going to make this brief. There is a mission, it's called the Isleta Mission. It was purchased about 2.5 years ago. Steve became aware that the Assemblies of God were selling it. It had been their Bible college, and it had 13 buildings that were in pretty bad repair, but usable. And he talked to the Rocky Mountain leaders, and they did purchase this facility. And there is a full-time pastor there and a full-time director of evangelism. And then a very large volunteer staff, which I am part of, and much of the renovation of the buildings has been done by a group of laymen that are called Laborers for Christ, and they come from the Dakotas, and quite a few of them from Michigan and Minnesota, and they spend the warm winter renovating buildings, and as soon as it gets to be May 1st, they say adios and head back to the nice climate. Of the north central area of the United States. But anyway, they have done a marvelous, they don't receive a cent of pay for this, and they've done a marvelous job in renovating these buildings. And the ministry is primarily to the total man. There is a program there that's called WICS, that is a government program, women, infants, and children. They also have Project Bravo there, which is, they rent a building from us, which is to distribute food, and handle some other things. I'm not exactly sure what they all do. And then the pastor that is there does have church on Sundays, and that is a growing congregation that is completely Hispanic. And they have English classes, a big VBS in summer, different things like that. But the program that I'm involved with is along with two other women from our congregation. We teach sewing to the Hispanic women. And the sewing machines were donated by different people, really again from about 10 or 12 different states, that people would hear about it and they would send money. And we were able to purchase 13 machines. And we can take as many as 20 in a class if the women can bring a machine or borrow a machine from somewhere else. And we've been doing this for a year and a half now, and we were getting a little tired. In fact, there were two of us that were thinking that we've been at this long enough, we really should try to get somebody else to do it. Except in this last month of May, when we were thinking this way, it's became quite apparent to us that we'll probably be there until we die. because what we have discovered is that the school district was going to offer a sewing class this summer, much the same way that we've done it. And we were trying to promote this to these ladies because the majority of them have been with us a year and a half, and we really feel that they could be working on their own. And we thought this would be a good way to kind of phase them out. And then in September, if we get some new teachers, they could start a new group. Or if we can't get some new teachers, at least we'll start a new group or something. Because we sensed that there was a dependency building up. And when we started passing out flyers and talking about this class that was going to be available in September, one by one, they would come up to me because of the 20 that we've had, 17 of them speak Spanish and 3 speak English. And of their 17, there's maybe about 5 or 6 who understand some English, because one of the gals that helps sew, she speaks no Spanish at all, and she's been at it the full time and has no problems. You can do a whole lot with fingers and saying it in English and then picking up a few words, and they say something back to you in Spanish and you pick up a few words and you make do. But anyway, one by one they began coming up to me and saying, "Are you going to be here this summer?" And because last summer we taught, and this year we felt we just couldn't do that all summer long, because it's every Tuesday all day, an 8-hour day, and with the children it was just really hard to do that. And so I was saying no, that we weren't going to do it, but fine teachers were going to be there. And one by one they began saying, "Well, we'll wait till September." Mm-hmm. "Well, we'll wait till September." "Well, we'll wait till September." "I don't think there's going to be anybody in the summer class." And we began to realize that what has happened is that they know how to sew now and they easily could move on. But we've developed a relationship there that they don't want to give up. Because Hispanic women have so little in their life that is theirs. They live in very poor conditions. Many times their husbands are really very unfaithful and don't supply for them and don't think of them as a person. They think of them as something to be used. And we have given them some worth. And we didn't, believe me, this came to us the third week of May, what has happened in a year and a half. We never had this as a goal. We never even thought about it. But it suddenly, the third week of May, the three teachers, we sat there eating our sandwich at lunch and we said, "We've got a problem." We are never going to be able to leave, because these women, they see this as someplace where they can come. And they can, and we talk about so many things while they're there. We talk about a sixth grader who's going to repeat for the third time. Or we talk about a child who's violent all the time. And I know what the problem is. And I know that they're not going to get any help because they're too poor to get any help. I know that child is probably autistic and hyperactive and, you know, a whole bunch of things combined. And I try to tell them some few steps that they could take, but I know that they're not going to have the resources available to do something like we could. And we talk about the husband that is trying to commit his wife to an insane asylum because that way he can justify marrying another woman. And she's there and she certainly isn't insane. She sews better than I do. but really he's trying to get the state to believe that he keeps taking her back to Juarez, to Mexico, and trying to get her institutionalized there. I mean, the guy is nuts. He's the one that's nuts. And so we talk a lot about that, and we talk about all kinds of things. And the way we run the program is that they pick out a pattern that they want to sew. We try to have some basic things that we want them to do. And we get donations of materials from all over. Again, sewing groups in Colorado will send us a little box of things. And we get sewing supplies and materials from all over. And if things are donated to us, we sell it at 25 cents a yard. When we're running low, we three teachers spend a whole day scouring the city for material that's on sale for a dollar a yard, because we find that is max of what they can pay for anything. And we provide the thread and the zippers and the pattern, and but we do try to have them, so that, and that again gives them some worth if they're able to pay for something, and just by paying for the material they feel a little bit more.
What she described with the relationships here is so much a part of the Hispanic or Mexican culture. If you're a pastor of a Mexican church and you leave without passing your mantle to the next Elisha, it's a disaster. It just totally falls apart. You've got to be willing to build that relationship, and that has to be done because people just are so related and so committed to that person, not just to the Lord, but to the person that helped them know the Lord, that kind of thing. We need to move along here, I can see that, but I wanted to share with you before we do run out of time a very special program that has been exciting to us because it's given us a sense of mission that we never would have had before, and a way of helping our whole church body in a special way. It occurred this way. It's our summer ministry program. Now for the fifth summer, we're working with a group of students. This summer it will be 10 students from Concordia College, St. Paul, Minnesota, and several other students from other places. The program began because we were thinking of calling another worker to help us in our ministry, and we began to see that there weren't very many people we could call. Our church hadn't done a very good job of training people for this type of ministry, and so rather than just lament and go on, we thought, well, what could we do to help make this happen and provide some training ourselves, and at the same time maybe get some help for the summer at least. So what we did is we worked out a program that has since grown and we've been refined over and over again to the point now that we have an 11-week program in the summer. As soon as we get back, we'll be starting this program now. And the way it works is we have a 3-week intense academic program to orientate these students, help them understand the culture and history of Mexico, the border. I'll be teaching about missiology, how the church operates in a mission setting with Hispanics particularly, and they'll be writing a 20-page paper. They get 16 hours of credit from Concordia for doing this. One of our members has gone up this spring to interview the students. What I've tried to do is involve as many of our members, too. I want to mention that because I don't want any of these programs to become just something that depends on me. If I were to leave, would it fall apart, that kind of thing. And I think that any of the things we've shared with you today will continue because we've tried to follow that principle that this is the church's work and not just ours. But I'm really amazed to see how certain members will latch on to a particular program and really get involved, you know. And this is what has happened. We try to link these students up in special ways with our members so that there's some give and take all summer long. They have what they call host families that they can go visit anytime. This is a part of the responsibility of this host family. If they get real tired of their fellow student and their roommate, they can go over and visit with this family and let off some steam or go swimming in the swimming pool or whatever they need to do. But the work program is also a part of this. They work then for the other, how many weeks would that be? Seven or 8 weeks with our churches. And it originally started working just with our particular parish, but now for this year we will have 3 parishes involved with teams of 2 to 4 students in each team. And one of the teams that's real exciting is a team up in Denver. They're going to be going after their study with us in El Paso up to Denver, working in a black congregation that is totally surrounded by Hispanics. And we had worked with this parish and training them a little bit before, and they now are reaching out to Hispanics, a black congregation, and they're going to have some of our workers this summer. Now I'll just quickly go over a couple of other ministries without making many comments, but we do have the normal type of VBS program and Sunday school program, except that in our case it involves about 80 to 90% Hispanic children, many of whom are not members of churches. In the past we've had around 250 students in our VBS program. This means that we have to have a lot of people to help us make this happen.
This year, because this program has become such a popular program in the community, we are having two VBS programs. We're going to have one in the morning and one in the evening. And this way we'll be able to have a little more manageable situation, you know, with fewer people, but we'll still end up having probably 250 in all.
It saves money also because we rent vans to bus the children. We find vans are easier to get drivers for than if you have buses. We only own one bus to begin with. And so it saves money because we can use the same van in the morning and in the evening. Last year we ran two different VBSs in 4 weeks and we had to pay rent for 4 weeks. This way we pay rent for 2 weeks.
Well, one of the neat things about the VBS and Sunday school program, which reaches so many Hispanic children, many of these kids may go to Mass, but they don't have any Sunday school program in their churches, and so their parents want them to have this. But we found also that there are quite a number of young people who have gone through our Sunday school for a number of years now and are coming to be of confirmation age. This year, for the first time, and we're just really surprised and excited about what's happening, we've had over half of our confirmation students coming from these Hispanic families. And, you know, it's just a tremendous thing to see Hispanic children be confirmed, and their parents come to this and they say, gee, you know, maybe we could do this too. Another final thing was about a very unique, I think, and this is not anything that we did, it's just something God brought about, but has been a real tremendous influence on our parish, and it's been our support for, but I guess it's a mutual support, a support for Bruce and Donna Husbands, a couple from Minnesota who sold their home and gave up their typical, you know, Midwestern Lutheran life and came to El Paso and decided to work among the Hispanic people. They became members of our congregation, and the parish that they had been pledged support from in Minnesota didn't come through, and they kind of were there and didn't have support, and our people saw their sincerity and they kind of responded, and now they pay most of their expenses to do their ministry. And I thought I'd ask Grace just to share a little bit about what these two people are doing.
Okay, first we should say they are under the auspices of Youth with a Mission, which is a very big worldwide evangelistic movement, and so that is who they are working for. But they receive no salary from them. So their salary is being picked up by members of our congregation individually and several of our guilds. Bruce is an agriculturalist, or good in that area. So he is working with small gardening among the Hispanics in Mexico, actually, and helping them to do dry country farming, because we do have problems with no rain. And so he has helped them to figure out what you can raise and how to use wisely the little water that is available. And he's also involved in an orphanage that he's kind of moved out of the farming and into the orphanage now. His wife Donna is just a very gifted individual that she gives a lot of our children's sermons just because she's got a real creative mind and a great storyteller, not because she's trained in any form of ministry, but this is just a gift that the Lord has given her. And
I think it's interesting to note the ecumenical thing that's happened here and how this has changed some of the attitudes of our people. The fact that Bruce works with Father Thomas, a Catholic priest who has this hunger mission, and also with a Pentecostal group that is running the orphanage, and now he's become the director of that, and how our members have gone with him and worked with him also, and this has helped them to become much more open to working with other church groups. And he and his wife, being so committed and working under difficult circumstances and with very little pay, has an influence upon the people more than if my wife and I were, you know, doing something like this. I think it says to them, hey, we should and could and can do these kinds of things ourselves. So we've been real thankful for some of the kinds of people God has sent us. The final ministry, and I'll just basically mention this off at the end, was the Hispanic Awareness Seminars and Weekends that we've sponsored over the years. we've developed a series of awareness weekends, or some have been three-day seminars, for pastors, youth groups, and congregations. The most recent one was a weekend. We gave a Hispanic Awareness Weekend for an LCA congregation in Albuquerque, a large church. Our church has about 250 members, and they had about 1,500 members, as they told us. And yet, when they went away, we were evaluating together, and they said, you know, we have this big church, but we don't have any outreach at all. And so they went back and started talking to the pastor and saying, how come we aren't doing anything in outreach? We've got Hispanics up here in Albuquerque, too. And that's kind of what we hope to see happen as we share our story, as we take people to the various things that we're doing and show them Mexico and the needs and so forth that we have there. Well, what are the results of these ministries that we've been doing? Well, one thing is that we don't have time to fight anymore. When we came, that was sort of one of the traditions, to get into some real interesting discussions during voters meetings, but today we just don't have time for those things. We seem to be involved in ministry too much. And I think we're more positive about ourselves. There's a positive image of ourselves. We see what's possible rather than stressing what the problems are. I think we're being stretched out all the time and trying something new. Our people have an interesting reaction when we think of starting something new again. They'll say, hey, let's do it. Or somebody will say, aren't we doing too much already? So we're stretched out in a good way in one sense, and we're stretched out in a bad sense. Also maybe needing to look at our resources and saying, can we take on something else? But we do have so many opportunities that require the involvement of a lot of people, so that many people can get involved. There's a slot for a lot more people when you've got a lot more going on, and it challenges people to not just sit there, but to want to be involved and to do something. And we're learning much. We're learning to appreciate Hispanics and what they can teach us, and they really have taught us a lot. We really have been thankful for that. For us as a congregation, we're continuing to grow. We're helping our members get a vision to share their faith and excitement and growing and sharing. And we're learning to wait on the Lord.
Could you put your name and address on the board?
Oh, okay. Thanks for your patience. It's got a little longer.